We continue our discussion of the growth of the organization of the church, and we are talking about the development of the idea of apostolic succession. And do you recall what we've said thus far, at least in general outlines? Let me remind you. We pointed out that the first century, you had, is there any question about this, you had the collegiate eldership. In the second century, there develops the monarchical bishop. But it did not develop in Rome, as we're going to be reminded of today, late. You do not have a pope in Rome. You do not have the Roman church in the first century having authority over the other churches. And the idea of a succession was not a succession of one man. It was a succession of the collegiate eldership. And it was not a succession of the office of apostle. You don't get that until the third century. It was simply an appointive succession. The idea being that these men were nominated by apostles and therefore thought to be a very good reason before they would be put out of office. That's where the idea got started. Isn't anything like what the idea came to be, as we're going to see. We come now to the dogma of apostolic succession on page 29 of our syllabus, the development of it. I point out that what had been an idea in the second century became a dogma in the third and became more or less universally accepted as doctrine, at least in the West. And let me simply say this here. Look up on the map. From now on, we're going to use the terms the East and the West, the Eastern Church, the Western Church. You need to know exactly what I mean by that. Now, the West was anything from Italy west. The main centers, the main cities, urban centers of the West were Rome and Carthage. Okay? The East is everything to the east of that. Greece, what we now call Greece, Asia Minor, is now Turkey, Palestine, Egypt, northern Egypt, and the center of Christianity, the strong, where was the heaviest concentration, the most churches, the highest percentage of Christians, was in what was called Asia Minor, in this area. Now, however, you must understand, let's take a sort of a cultural look at this in the broadest possible terms. But the people in the East looked upon the Romans as barbarians, and they had reason for this. The Romans weren't good at anything but law and war. When it came to culture, law, war, and business. But and of course, I'm not saying that this was entirely justified, but the civilization was old. In the East had tradition. You talk about, in other words, you get the Romans who could go back maybe 300 or 400 years and look at their greatness. It's hard to impress the Egyptians, you see, who went back 2,000 years. It's hard to impress the people of Asia Minor and the Mesopotamian Valley because they went back to the ancient Phrygian. They had high cultures back in the 2nd millennium B.C., the 3rd millennium B.C. And here these Romans come out of the woods and stomp over everybody. And they had, and when you went west of Rome, you were out in the boondocks. You went north of Rome, you crossed these small rivers, and you're up into the areas of the Germans, which was wild country, tribal existence. And you'd be careful, you see. So it's like Rome was really out of it. And that's how they looked upon it. And it never changed, never had changed. These still lived in the west as being barbaric. So that's what I mean by the East and the West, okay? Well, it's a story about how they looked at culture. You heard the story about the fellow who was giving a guided tour during our bicentennial in Boston, and he was taking some tourists through Boston. He pointed to one building and said, "This building is 200 years old." And one of the tourists who was from Syria said, "Boy, I can't wait to get back to Damascus and tell them that." Well, but in Damascus, until a building's 2,000 years old, it's not even antique. You say, 200 years old. Oh, my. You see, isn't that funny? that's sort of how the East looked upon the West. Well, okay, and you have to understand this, because this division is always going to be there, and still is. Ultimately, it resulted in the division. You had the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Western Roman Catholic Church. We're going to see this later. But just sort of see that it has cultural antecedents. Now, The basic idea of apostolic succession, as the dogma developed, was the idea of bishops as successors to the office of apostle. Bishops as successors. Now note this, in the third century it is bishops. Did I underline the word S? It's not till later that you get the idea of a bishop. One Rome, or one Roman pontiff. But now it's just bishops as successors. But now, so in other words, before you had the idea of a single bishop with authority, you had the idea that bishops succeeded to the office of apostle, not simply appointed from the apostles. And you remember my distinction. It is, you have a transition from the idea, and this takes place up in the third century, from the succession from the apostles, not of the office, to the succession of the apostolic office. Yes.
What is a good definition of dogma?
Dogma is in Roman Catholicism. It's a belief which has to be believed. It's a doctrine that is a matter of salvation. For the Roman Catholic, that's a good question. Roman Catholic Church has many teachings that are not dogmas. They teach many things you do not have to believe to be saved. But once it becomes an official dogma, then you have to believe it to go to heaven. For instance, until 1951, for several centuries, the Roman Catholic Church taught that Mary ascended back to the Father as Jesus did. But you could deny it and still go to heaven, not be a heretic. But after 1951, it became a dogma. Then, if you denied it, you were declared a heretic and you had to repent or go to hell. That's the difference.
These dogmas aren't necessarily based on
facts. Not hardly. But we sort of make that distinction between matters of faith and matters of opinion. But the Roman Catholic Church takes it one step further. They have, for instance, made the lives of many of their saints. Some of them are dogmas, some of them aren't. In other words, they say this is true, but you don't have to believe it to be saved. But once it becomes dogma, then it's a matter of salvation. That's what it means. Yeah. Well, it's not exactly the same because the Roman Church has an official process by which a teaching becomes a dogma. And by the way, this is the kind of freedom. Of course, we'll see this later. But all over the world, it leaves them free to teach pretty much what they want to. Yet, if you say what the Roman Catholic Church does is, and has done this for centuries, they teach all kinds of what we would consider unacceptable doctrines, like the doctrine in Italy taught that Mary died on the cross as well, that Mary died for the sins of man as well as Jesus did. You know that there's a cross in Rome with Mary on one side and Jesus on the other. I have an uncle and a cousin, each of whom took a picture of it, and I've seen the picture. They were there. I haven't seen it myself. But as soon as you accuse the Roman Catholic Church of teaching something like that, they will fall back and say, oh, you're just making that up because that's not our dogma. And they confuse people. Get that? Because let's say, well, this look like it's not, it has never, you know, that's not our dogma. Well, you see, there's a big gap, and always has been, for several centuries between Roman Catholic teaching and Roman Catholic dogma. Yes. Well, wait. Let's get on, and this question will be answered. Although the idea circulated in the second century, it is first worked out and presented in a systematic way by Cyprian, Bishop of Carthage. Is Carthage in the east or the west?
West.
In the west, you see. Carthage was sort of a sister city to Rome. You got this? So Cyprian, 8250, it was talked about and generally rejected, but he worked it out. And I make a number of observations about it here, the dogma of apostolic succession. As he worked it out, the bishops were successors to the apostolic office, the representatives of Christ. Keep in mind, it's still bishops, not one man. Secondly, they are mediators between God and man, and here in AD 250, you have the beginning of the idea of the elder or bishop as a priest. And a mediator between God and man, the same way that the Levites were mediators under the Old Covenant. The bishops are channels of grace. If you're going to come to God, you have to come to the bishop. The church, therefore, exists in the bishops. They are the church. By the way, this is the official teaching of the Roman Catholic Church. The bishops are the church. The church consists on earth, on the earthly church, consists in the bishops as representatives of the Pope, the bishop of the whole church. And by the way, the church is the bishops and those in fellowship with the bishops, because these are the apostles of any generation. You see that? And by the way, that is the Roman Catholic definition of a Christian. According to Roman Catholics, no one will be in heaven who is not in fellowship with the Bishop of Rome, because the church on earth consists of the Bishop of Rome and those who are in fellowship with him, those whom he recognizes. And lesser bishops, archbishops, and the lesser clergy are simply representatives of the bishop of the whole church. When you're dealing, when the local Christian, as they would say it, deals with the local priest, this priest is representing the next step up, and ultimately represents the Pope. Y'all see that? So the church consists of the bishop. We all often laugh at that. Often Roman Catholics will get on talk shows and try to act like they're very ecumenical and open-minded. No, we've never said everybody else, all non-Catholics are going to hell. It's absolutely false. Absolutely false. I think that's what their dogma is. And if you pin them down, they'll admit it. They speak with forked tongue. Because do you not teach that no one will be in heaven is not in fellowship with the Bishop of Rome? Well, yes, that's what the church teaches. Okay, the concept was used to rationalize the monarchical bishop. They had this one fellow in charge of one church. Cyprian assigned this authority to all the monarchical bishops. Who had this authority? Exactly which bishops were these channels of grace? And who exactly which bishops were the bishops in whom the church consisted, you see? Well, Cyprian said it was the monarchical bishops. Now, by the way, but he assigned, now listen to this to me, he assigned equal authority to all of the bishops, all the monarchical bishops. Now, that is, the Roman Catholic Church teaches that Cyprian was on the way to the truth, as I note here, because they said, well, Cyprian just didn't realize that they did not have equal authority, that the Bishop of Rome had authority over the other bishops. See, we're still in the 3rd century. And remember our little summary back here on page 28? 3rd century what? One bishop over a diocese or a group of churches in one area, that you see sort of a city-state area. And so the bishops were now over more than one congregation, one church, bishops, where in the beginning you had several, had a plurality of bishops or elders over one church. Now you had many churches and one bishop. But he assigned these sort of, we would call diocesan bishops, he assigned them equal authority in his theory. This concept began, this really had a transforming effect upon the historic church. What about the elders? We recall that in the second century they made a distinction between the bishop and the elders. What about the elders? Well, by the second century there is the concept of the clergy upon whom the laity depends. I actually forbid you to use the word clergy and laity. It's appearing in our periodicals all the time now, but it didn't used to appear. It's like the word pastor. You used to never read the word pastor in the Christian Standard, the Restoration Herald, or the word clergy or laity. It's absolutely an unbiblical distinction, and today you read it all the time. But I forbid you to use it, and should I see you in print using that word, I shall come and do significant violence to your body. It's a false concept, the idea of classes of Christians, yes. A laity, a layman, you heard the term layman? Yes, a layman, the layman collectively is the laity. So the clergyman collectively is the clergy. And so you have this clergy-laity, first and second class Christians. Now I indicate here in a very brief form the evolution of the office of elders. In the first century, elders and bishops were the same office. The second century, well, look at this, bishops, the word bishop was reserved for a single leader. The elders became an advisory board, misspelled there in the syllabus, which is like the second, like the most many denominational churches have it today. Third century, or close to it, they have deacon boards as opposed to elder boards. Now, some churches have elder boards. Third century and following, elders became priests under the mediating monarchical bishop who mediated between God and man on behalf of the bishop. You got this? From the third century on, the elders became the priests. Began to be the priests who mediated, who actually served the people on behalf of the monarchical bishop. But now the monarchical bishop is not a bishop over one church. He's a bishop over several churches. So you would have you would have the local elders are now priests. You got this? Let me repeat this. Are now priests. And they are mediating between God and man. They are channels of grace on behalf of the bishop. You do not yet have a central bishop, like a pope. But you have a series of monarchical bishops, diocesan bishops, bishops over areas, like Greater Rome or Southern Italy. And later on, they would even break it down further. Deacons became assistants without mediating power. They came to occupy administrative positions. And how were they? The means of selection. The bishops were nominated by the clergy, just as the apostles had nominated. So these men are now representing the apostles. They are the apostles. They have succeeded to the office of apostles. So just as the apostles nominated, so the bishops were nominated by the clergy, but always elected or approved by the people. Still were. Now we come to the growing importance of Rome. Here's the question. How did the idea develop that there is no salvation except in obedience, not simply to the bishop, but to the bishop of Rome? Well, let me give you a very brief history of the church at Rome. I'm just going to go over this very quickly. It was founded by unknown disciples. It's in existence by A.D. 50. We know because, according to Suetonius, we had the expulsion of the Jews and some Christians were run out of there at that time, Acts 18:1. We know that. Paul longed to impart some spiritual gift, Romans 8:1, suggesting that no apostle had ministered to them this early. By the way, no miraculous gifts listed in the Roman letter, unless you list, depends on how you look at the word prophecy, which has, but the others aren't mentioned. That's probably just normal preaching. According to tradition, Paul was martyred at Rome. Was Peter ever in Rome? Well, probably. He wrote 1 Peter 5:13. Peter writes from Babylon. Now, three possibilities offer in this. One is he's writing from Jerusalem, which I think is a real possibility. Others, he's writing from Babylon, but see, Babylon was sort of the prototype of the wicked, sinful city, persecuting city. The question is it Jerusalem? For instance, is Babylon in the book of Revelation Jerusalem or Rome? I think it's probably Rome. My thinking is, and you can't prove it, I think he probably was in Rome. He possibly was in Jerusalem. I do not think he was in the literal Babylon at all. My professor, when I was going to Bible college, thought it was just the literal Babylon, the old city of Babylon itself in the Mesopotamian Valley. I think not, because in Jesus' day, or in Paul's day, or Peter's day, Babylon was nowhere. You know, it'd be like writing from Biflo. It was a garbage dump with a few houses around it. That's all it was. It was totally insignificant in that day, and there would be no reason whatever for to think that Peter was actually in the city of Babylon. Babylon is to the east. Babylon's not over in here. I don't know on this map, but there. See, Babylon was great. But see, Babylon was gone. You understand what I'm saying? So since Babylon was just a backwash, you know, nothing town, I see no reason to think that Peter would have been there. Making them sitting there ministering and writing, because there wasn't anybody else there. Just a few squatters, nomads, and I don't know who all was there, but it was. But anyway, was Peter ever bishop of Rome? No, because in Peter's day, the Roman church didn't have a monarchical bishop. Did Peter found the church at Rome? Most likely not. The tradition that Peter found the church in Rome dates from the late 2nd century. For instance, the letter of Ignatius, which is to the church at Rome, we mentioned Ignatius, this man on his way to Rome being to be martyred, writing a series of letters. We read from Ignatius' letter to Smyrna. Well, in his letter to Rome, AD 112, he makes no mention whatever of Peter. But late in the 2nd century, this idea grows that Peter founded the church. We look at our sources. We've already mentioned Clement of Rome. We pointed the fact that there's a complete absence of a mention of either a monarchical bishop either at Rome or at Corinth, even though that was the organization of the church, the leaders of the church was the matter under discussion. We've already talked about the letter of Ignatius and 112. This is the another letter. This is the one to Rome, which I mentioned above here. He treats Rome as an important church, but not as one having authority over other churches. This is AD 112. In fact, his letter indicates
that there was no monarchical bishop at Rome at a time when other churches did have one. Remember I mentioned that? Interesting that the monarchical bishop developed late at Rome, apparently, from all we can tell. Well, Irenaeus of Lyon, AD 185, he was the one who wrote against heresies, and you've been introduced to him. He considered the church at Rome to be the most illustrious and the oldest church, founded by the most illustrious of the apostles, Peter and Paul, and the canon or standard for all Christianity. So Irenaeus, AD 185, is the first time we really find the idea set forth that the church at Rome, that the bishops at Rome, not the bishop now, the bishops at Rome would have more, and the church itself would have priority or prominence over the other churches. He considered to be, but however, this is limited. Irenaeus considered the Roman church to be the church in the West most likely to have the truth because it was the only one founded by the apostles. Now let me sort of summarize what Irenaeus said. Well, he didn't say, the Roman Catholic Church liked to cite Irenaeus, but they really misquote him. He did not say that the church at Rome had authority over all other churches. He said, now keep in mind, he was concerned about heresies. And I've already talked about how this development was in response to the pressure of heresies, the pressure of a heresy. What he said was that in the West, of the churches in the West, and that was kind of on the edges of things, the church most likely to be depended upon to have the truth as opposed to heresy was the church at Rome, because he apparently accepted this idea that it had been founded by Peter and Paul. There's no evidence for that. Now, however, he said, there are many churches in the East that would have equal dependability. But again, he's not saying they have authority. He's simply saying they're most likely to have the truth. You got me? But only in the West. He never appeals to the authority of the Bishop of Rome, as I indicate here, or suggests other bishops should obey him. It was not a matter of doctrine, but of practicality. A part of the method of Irenaeus in identifying the true apostolic tradition, you see, what is the truth as opposed to heresy, he appeals to history, scripture, tradition, and reason. That's how he got at the original teaching. And I wish I had time to talk about this for a long time, but he appealed to Irenaeus, as I summarized things, was appealing to an apostolic succession of doctrine, not of authority. And he attributed this to Rome only in the West, but not arbitrary authority. Simply saying, when you're in the West, you're most likely to find the truth being preached in the church at Rome, that being the standard, than any other church in the West. But he did not, you follow me? That's a long way from assigning authority to the Bishop of Rome over all the other bishops of all the other churches in the world. The Roman Catholic Church often suggests that Irenaeus did, but she absolutely did not.
All the other churches in the West practicing heresy then?
No. It's just a question of who decides what is heresy and what isn't, necessarily. He's simply saying, if you want to be sure, check with the leaders at Rome. By the way, the elders, when he says the bishop, the church at Rome, what he meant was, see, each church, by the church, they meant the whole area. They had a body of elders, as well as a monarchical bishop, and these men were trained teachers who, for the most part, I'm persuaded, were full-time employees of the church, who were scholars. It would be like, the church became a school. We're going to see this later. So it is a body of teachers, body of elders, who were regularly teaching. You got that? Men who were just what I call professional teachers almost. And which body of professional, you know, these elders have to teach? Which body of elders was the most dependable? You know, the ones found at Rome. Well, Irenaeus suggests. Why? Because that church goes back to it was founded by the most illustrious of apostles, Paul and Peter. Which is probably not right, but anyway, that's what he said. We're a long way down the road now with the late second century. Y'all see what's going on? Kind of complicated, I realize that. You can go back to the syllabus and trace it down. Now, we're going to talk about the Easter dispute, and the reason we're going to talk about it, yes, sir. No, Easter. Thank you. The Easter dispute, I'm going to talk because it's interesting in and of itself, but I'm going to look at it now. I've outlined it for you here, because here we see in the second century the development rather rapidly of the idea by the Bishop of Rome that he is in charge because he is the Bishop of Rome. Now, he got the idea, and we'll see this, okay? That's where we're going. There were two phases, AD 154 and AD 189. We'll look at first, of course. There was a dispute in the church. It was just a dispute, mainly between the East and the West, over whether the resurrection should be celebrated on a certain day of the month or on a certain day of the week. By the way, Resurrection Day, what we call Easter, I prefer Resurrection Day, was the big day of the year for the ancient church. The question is, do you follow the Jewish calendar and therefore have the resurrection day appear after the Passover, no matter which day of the week it falls upon? Or do you, are you with me now? Or do you celebrate it according, or do you say, because Jesus rose on the first day of the week, we will always celebrate on the first day of the week nearest to that phase of the moon, which determined the time of the Passover? Therefore, it could fall at various times in the year, but we always pick the nearest first day of the week because Jesus rose on the first day of the week. And it's just a dispute. In Asia Minor, the East, again, where the heaviest concentrations of Christians and churches were, they traced the tradition to John. They said John said to recommend it, having it on any day of the week following the Jewish calendar. Now, whether John did or not, I don't know, but they said he did. He recommended that. Again, it's not a matter of doctrine, you see. Question of what day do you pick? So it would correspond to the Passover each year. So some of the Easter might be on Tuesday one year and Wednesday the next. In the other areas, besides Asia Minor and in the West, the other areas of the East and in the West, they celebrate on the first day of the week nearest the phase of the moon, as we do today. Well, so that was the discussion. In AD 55, Polycarp from Smyrna, remember Polycarp who was martyred? The elder at Smyrna, Bishop of Smyrna, he went to Rome to discuss this and other issues. Anicetus, who we've already looked at, who was the monarchical bishop in Rome now, in the second century, early second century, or he was one of the leaders of Rome. The monarchical bishop was just about developing, so he probably was. They could not agree, and so they agreed to disagree. They talked about, follow me, here's two bishops, Anicetus and Polycarp, one from Asia Minor, Smyrna, one from Rome, and they just don't agree, so they just agree to disagree, as I've said. The point is, there was no attempt by the Roman bishop to impose his views on the churches of Asia Minor. Well, the argument continued. In 189, a little over 30 years later, it flared again. This time, Polycrates of Ephesus, roughly the same area that Polycarp is from, of course Polycarp's dead now, Polycrates of Ephesus wrote a strong letter to Victor, who's now Bishop of Rome, urging this Johannine tradition. What was that? To have it according to the Jewish calendar any day of the week. Victor threatened, he wrote back, and he said, we're going to observe it always on Sunday, because I say so, I'm the Bishop of Rome, and if you don't agree with me, I'll excommunicate you. You following? 30 years before, Anicetus had just said, okay, we can't agree, and let it drop. Now you have, in over 30 years, a Bishop of Rome who this idea is going very quickly, hasn't it? It's not a matter of equals disagreeing. He says, you have to do what I say, take my view of it, or I'll excommunicate you. But keep in mind, he got this idea. Nobody else had it. See what I mean? It shocked Irenaeus, and he was a bishop in the West. And he pointed out, he said, well, this is unreasonable. Who do you think you are? No matter what, you can imagine what the people in the East said. They didn't like the West anyway. But even in the West, it was objected to. Eusebius said records that the matter did not please the bishops, and Victor was rebuked. All the other bishops, East and West, told Victor to come down off his high and mighty and quit acting like God. That's not what they said, but that's what they meant. Who do you think you are threatening to excommunicate another bishop just because he doesn't agree with you. It's not a matter of faith. Okay? Now, we come now to Callistus, who was the bishop of Rome in 217 to 222. And here's another issue. The problem this time was what to do about people who had grievously sinned, had been excommunicated, wanted to be restored. What about the person who really falls away, but he comes back and wants to be restored to the church? Callistus claimed the right to decide himself. Now, the important thing is, on the basis of Matthew 16, whatever is bound on earth shall have been bound in heaven, he said, a very important claim, this applies to me. It applied to Peter. Peter had the right to decide who could go to heaven, who couldn't go to heaven, who could be in the church, who couldn't be in the church, which is not exactly true. And I am Peter's successor, so he claimed the authority. Here's for the first time you have explicitly a bishop of Rome claiming the authority of Matthew 16 to forgive sins. Now the point is, regardless of how you feel about whether they should be restored or not, the important point I'm making here is that he claimed the right to decide. Now, he does not claim to be the only bishop with this right, but he claims the right to decide. And this claim was strongly opposed by Tertullian and the others. You see, this idea is growing. They said, no, you don't have the right. You're a bishop, and you mediate for the people, but you don't have that much authority. See, and neither do we. He didn't claim it just for himself, but it's a very important claim. But keep in mind, it was rejected universally. Now we come to Stephen, Bishop of Rome, 254 to 257. We're getting on down now in the years, getting down toward the end of our period, aren't we? Within 100 years, less than 100 years of the end of our period. This is very important. A controversy arose between Stephen and Cyprian of Carthage over the question of rebaptism of those who came into the Catholic Church from Orthodox or unorthodox or heretical groups. The question was, so we had three issues. You got this? First issue was the date of Easter. And we looked at it, it's interesting in and of itself, but we've looked at it because we see, it furnishes the background for these rising claims, especially by the Bishop of Rome. Second issue was, what about those who want to be restored when they've committed terrible crimes, terrible sins? Third, there are a number of heresies around now. What about those who were baptized in a heretical group? We're going to talk about these heretical groups later, okay? But just reserve your thinking on that. What about a person who was baptized in a heretical group? A Marcionite or a Montanist or something like that. We'll talk about those later. If they want to come into the true church, the Catholic Church, the Orthodox Church, do they have to be baptized again? The two differed. Again, Cyprian of Carthage claimed that heretical baptism was not valid. They were never baptized into Christ, into the church, because what they were baptized into wasn't the church. Heretical baptism is, for instance, I would say if a person is baptized by the Jehovah's Witnesses, because the Jehovah's Witnesses are heretics, they deny the deity of Jesus and the resurrection, tell me. The Jehovah's Witnesses are heretics, they deny, tell me. What that word means, they deny the deity of Jesus and the resurrection of Jesus. Okay? So that anybody baptized into the Jehovah's Witness, I take it, I would say they have not been baptized. Yes, there are other groups who have teaching similar stuff. But the issue was, follow me, if they had a false doctrine of Jesus, which most of them did, heresies, follow me, should they be baptized on the basis of a correct faith? Well, Cyprian said yes. Well, I think Cyprian was right. I mean, I'm right, or Cyprian was right, but anyway, I agree with him for what it's worth. But Stephen disagreed. But the reason I'm talking about this here now is that Stephen did what Victor tried to do. He threatened to excommunicate Cyprian, claiming authority on the basis of Matthew 16 again. But Cyprian didn't say, whereas before, on the other page, Tertullian said it didn't apply to any bishops. Cyprian said, that applies to all bishops, but not just to you. We all have the authority to forgive sins. Or before, you found me before, just the Roman bishop claimed it. The other said none of us have it. Now, he claims it. And they say, we all have it. So since we all have this authority coming from Matthew 16 to bind or loose sins, then Stephen, Bishop of Rome, has no right to excommunicate Cyprian, Bishop of Carthage. Cyprian had strong support from the bishops in the East. For instance, and I put this in our syllabus, interesting to read, Firmilian, the important bishop of Caesarea — Caesarea is a very important city — in Cappadocia, not Caesarea in, it was Caesarea after here in Asia Minor, Cappadocia, this Caesarea, not the Caesarea in Judea, okay? This Caesarea, can you see that? Very important city. So Firmilian, who's a very important bishop in the East, he writes this. And he wrote to Cyprian, his fellow bishop, about what Stephen up there in Rome was trying to do. Very interesting. I read, "And here am I, am justly indignant at such open and manifest folly in Stephen, that he who so boasts of the seat of his episcopate and contends that he holds the succession from Peter, on whom the foundations of the church were laid, introduces many other rocks. Upon this rock I'll build my church, and builds anew many churches, in that by his authority he maintains baptism among them." That is, he claims the right to decide. But whoso approves their baptism must needs also maintain of those baptized that the church also is with them. That was the issue. "What strifes and dissensions you stirred up." Now he's addressing Stephen. "Have stirred up through the churches of the whole world. And how great sin you have heaped up when you cut yourself off from so many flocks. For you cut yourself off. Do not deceive yourself. For he is truly the schismatic who has made himself an apostate from the communion of the unity of the church. For while you think that all may be excommunicated by you, you have excommunicated yourself alone from all." Which is a lousy way to treat the Pope. You got that? Now, interesting, you see. Here you find the Bishop of Rome, late 3rd century, trying to excommunicate the Bishop of Carthage over this issue of heretical baptism. But that's the kind of thing. Was it accepted? Well, they said, so Firmilian, in a letter to address Stephen, says, "All you have succeeded in doing is what? You didn't excommunicate anybody. All you've done is become a schismatic. You'd excommunicated yourself." Which gives you an idea that the Bishop of Rome had authority came from him, not from anybody else. So Cyprian certainly didn't recognize in the West, but now you find these claims being made. Are you following the progression of this? This makes sense. This sort of evolves, doesn't it? Gradually grows. Now let me say a word. I want to talk about something number 6. To help us understand what's going on, you must understand this idea of a man who's the bishop of the church in the capital city. The ancients thought this way, and this helps us. I'm not justifying it, I'm explaining it. The ancients thought this way. The ancients thought in terms of the city, not the nation. And they thought this way, that the importance, the relative or comparative importance of a city attached to the citizens of that city. That is, if you came from an important city, then you were important. Now, we don't think that way so much, except the only people who think that way now are people from Texas. You know, I'm from Texas, therefore the world ought to, you know. One Texas, there was a Texas senator who had a team going to Africa and to look things over, and he said, "Let's humor the natives, and if they say that Africa is bigger than Texas, we'll let them think that." Well, anyway, for instance, Paul, this is the way they thought. Remember how Paul defended himself? They thought Paul was a rascal, and he says, "I am from Tarsus. I am a citizen of no mean city." And often they would name men from their city. Simon of Cyrene. Now, we don't think that way, do we? We do not automatically assume that a man becomes relatively important compared to his fellows if the city he's from is more important than their city. But the ancients tended to think that way. You got that? If I came from a more important city than you came from, the city of your birth, then I am more important than you are. Can you buy that? You see? Well, I could just talk for a long time on that. But the ancients tended to think this way. And so, do you see how this helps us to understand why the bishop of the church at Rome would tend to think that because his city was more important, at least he thought it was, than other cities, certainly at least in the West, that therefore his office had more authority. Now, that is not the explanation of why he did this. But I think it helps us to understand this kind of thing was done. That's the way they operated. The church, another reason is the church at Rome saw itself as the only one in the West with an apostolic tradition. Rome took the position, it's probably not true. If it's true, we can't prove it. You got that idea of who founded the church at Rome? But by this time, Rome sees itself as the only church in the West now that was started by an apostle or apostles. Therefore, they had more. They were more important. And to their credit, the church at Rome felt a sense, you can see this in their letters, in the documents, the church at Rome apparently felt a sense of responsibility for the other churches. It was a strong church, it was a wealthy church, and they apparently took a very patronizing attitude. And by the way, it says it's the old rule of human nature, you can just write it down and believe it, that whoever pays the piper calls the tune. And one of the reasons that through this period, the Bishop of Rome claimed authority of other churches was that they were often helping other churches financially. And it takes a great deal of spiritual maturity, by the way, to support somebody financially or to help them financially and not try to exercise authority over them. We just do this, don't we? That's how we operate, by the way, as well. Do we not? In other words, if I'm paying the bills, I'm going to have the say. And that was partly involved. But I simply point out, last of all, and this ends this discussion, ends this part of the discussion, that the churches in the East never have recognized the expanding claims of Rome. But do you see where we are? We're coming down toward the end of the 3rd century. What about the papacy? Do you understand now why I say the Roman Catholic historians had to depend upon later authority to establish the idea of a pope back here? Let me sort of summarize again. Perhaps I'm doing too much summarize. Here we are, pushing toward the end of the 3rd century. Where does the issue stand? Well, we've come this far. We've got a bishop in Rome who has claimed the authority to excommunicate another bishop, the Bishop of Carthage. And who has recognized this claim? Answer, nobody but himself. In fact, in the East, one of the leading bishops in the East, Firmilian, says, all you've done is make a fool of yourself. You try to cut us off. All you do is cutting yourself off. And the point is, Cyprian in the West didn't recognize this. So all you've got is a guy making a claim that he cannot make stick. It's not accepted anywhere. And of course, later on, it came to be accepted in the West, we're going to see. But it never has been accepted in the East. And listen to me, the East was the strongest as a land area. That's where most of the Christians were. So the majority of the Christians in these early centuries were in the East. And the majority of Christians never have, using Christian historical sense. They didn't accept it then. And they didn't accept it now. And they didn't reject it simply on theological grounds. They did reject it on exegetical or theological grounds. But these were people. One of the things they undoubtedly said was, who does that barbarian in that Johnny-come-lately town up there think he's doing telling us, you know, what's right and what's wrong, what we can believe and what we can't believe, who we can baptize, who we can't baptize, when we celebrate Easter and we don't celebrate Easter, who does he think he is? Well, by the way, again, we see these cultural reasons. We have an analogy to this in our culture. For instance, the old established intellectual community of the East, Harvard and Yale and their satellites, they think that the real America ends when you get west of Boston. And you simply are not going to tell them anything. By the way, the farther east you go, the harder it is to tell somebody. It's very hard, it's very hard for a Midwestern American to tell an Eastern, one of the Eastern old families anything. See, they think that That's why, you know, they think that when you get a mail order subscription to the New York Times, you're flying in culture. So they send culture west in the New York Times. And there's a few, yeah. And they really think that way, by the way. You just try to tell somebody from the New England states anything. You just, as a group now, by the way, people from there will tell you that. But then you go further east to get to England, and you can tell the British or even less, you know, what does anybody from the colonies know? And then the ultimate frustration is to try to tell a German something, you know, in the world of education or culture. I mean, they think culture ends west of the Rhine. And if you don't think they operate like that, you don't know how people operate. They do. Now, in Ohio, they think it ends at the Ohio River. You know, you get into Kentucky, you know, what do they have to say? And you have this regional snobbery. See? And I want us to have a...